very much. They've lost my luggage on Air Canada, so I'm going to be wearing Fields Institute t-shirts all week long. I'm actually mostly at UCLA and not at Imperial College, and I don't know why I didn't change it on my slide. I'm 9 months a year at UCLA and 3 months a year at Imperial College. And this is work that's sort of been around for about the past, we've been doing for about the past 5 years. And the person most, who's taught me most about this is Ben Chandran, who was a postdoc of mine, who's now at Iowa. A lot of the ideas I'll talk about today are due to Ben, very smart young man. But the rest of these people contribute in various different ways. I'm not going to talk very much about the astrophysics itself, because this is a meeting at a maths institute, and I'll try and describe to you what the calculational issues are that we would like to solve. I'll tell you some of the ideas, the physics ideas that are behind it, and some of the mathematics problems, but of course I won't show many equations. The older you get, the less equations you want to show. Astrophysics is so hard, and the amount of data that you actually get from distant objects is very, very small, and so you look for very simple models of what you have, because anything else you couldn't tell the difference anyway, usually. And so most of the analysis of magnetized things in the universe, and there's lots of magnetized things, the galaxies are magnetized, clusters of galaxies are magnetized, stars are magnetized, are treated using MHD, which of course is a fluid theory, which relies on having a short mean free path. But in fact, especially in the sort of diffuse objects like the universe as a whole, the mean free path of particles can be absolutely astronomical. And this means that MHD is, in some sense, a bad approximation. It's not such a bad approximation because, to some extent, the magnetic field replaces at least part of the mean free path physics with a Lama radius of the particles going around the field line, and therefore MHD is not sort of qualitatively wrong in some instances where you would otherwise have thought it was kind of stupid to use. But I'm going to talk about how we go beyond MHD and get a much better description of these kind of plasmas. And the particular problem I've been interested in for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years is where do magnetic fields come from in the universe? And so we're deeply interested in these regions of the universe that have are very diffuse. They have like, well, I don't know, one particle, a hundredth of a particle per cc in terms of plasma density, where great vast regions of the universe where magnetic field seems to be and where galaxies are forming, where structure is forming. In those regions, we would like a much better description of the plasma physics. But we would can't possibly go about solving, you know, the collisional Boltzmann equation in that region, right? It would just it would be far too difficult to do. So we'd like some kind of reduced description of the plasma that has most of the key physics points in it. One of the things about these regions is that they're permeated by very tangled magnetic field lines. We can tell that from various data, mostly through the rotation of polarization of light passing through the plasma. The Faraday effect rotates the polarization vector of radio waves passing through those plasmas, and from that we can tell there's magnetic field. And if we look at several lines of sight, we see the magnetic field here is different than the magnetic field here, so we can tell over what distance the magnetic field sort of changes its sign. I would like, for these cases where you've got very tangled magnetic field lines, to develop a set of sort of transport coefficients that accurately describe the transport along those field lines in those tangled cases, so that we could have some kind of fluid description with transport terms in it that's accurate description of the plasma. This is actually an image of one of the kind of objects that we're very interested in. The galaxy, of course, is arranged on a hierarchy of the universe. Is arranged in a hierarchy of different scales. And, you know, there are galaxies and there are stars within galaxies, but galaxies are clustered into small clusters and superclusters and various different sized groupings of galaxies. And most of the baryons, non-dark matter, in the universe is contained between galaxies in these big clusters. There's probably this picture of X-ray emission from a plasma, right? And it's in the Abel galaxy cluster. And in this cluster, there's about 1,000 galaxies. You don't see them in the picture because they're not emitting in this X-ray band. There's about 1,000 galaxies moving around. And between the galaxies is this hot plasma. The plasma has quite substantial temperatures between a kilovolt and 10 kilovolts, like millions to 100 million degrees. And what you're seeing is the emission of X-rays from the glowing plasma. And what you see, for instance, is that little hole there has said to be a hole supported. You've got the pressure of the plasma, and right there you've probably got no plasma, and the pressure is being supported probably by a concentration of magnetic field in there. This has been said to be one of the evidence for sort of balls of tangled magnetic field throughout these structures. As I said, we can also tell this magnetic field from the rotation of polarization of light coming through here. Well, radio waves, not light. Inside those are quite often these extraordinary galaxies, which we call radio galaxies. This is Hydra. It's in the Hydra cluster. It's a Hydra A galaxy is right there. It probably has a massive black hole, and it spews out a tail of very excited plasma emitting in the radio waves. So these are radio pictures. This one here tells you something else about these galaxies, is that they're moving through the plasma, because this one spewing out that way drags out a tail behind it because it's moving through the plasma at about 1,000 kilometers a second, quite quickly, really. And so these galaxies and the jets that come out, these are the famous radio jets, and the jets that come out of them are stirring the plasma up, and that has a profound effect on the dynamics. Now, as a plasma physicist, right, we want to write down sort of the characteristics of these plasmas. Right at the center of this, it's very important plasmas, these cluster plasmas, because they're really the prototype for where the kind of stuff out of which galaxies are formed. So as you're forming all the structure in the universe, you've got these great big balls of plasma, right, are condensing down in the middle here, is not actually hotter. This is the colder bit of the plasma. It's just emitting more, right? And in this bit, it's denser, so this is the inner region, and this is the outer region out here, right? And what's happening in the middle here is plasma is falling on and accreting on to and making galaxies bigger, or even, in some cases, taking little fragments of stuff and starting to make a galaxy out of it. Right? So it's one of those regions where we're seeing the birth of structure in the universe. The outer regions of this plasma is incredibly hot, like 10 kilovolts, like fusion plasmas. But the density is very, very low. The scale, 3 × 10^24 centimeters, really, really very large objects. A galaxy, for instance, is about 10^22 centimeters across. 3 × 10^21 centimeters across. So the size of a galaxy in here is almost unseeable in size. And the scale of this thing is what's called megaparsecs. The magnetic field in there is a microgauss. But this is pretty darn significant on this scale, even though it's only 1/1,000,000th of the size of the Earth's magnetic field. And the scale of the magnetic field, which we can tell because this patch, for instance, rotates the light one way and this rotates the radio waves one way, radio waves the other way, we can tell that the magnetic field varies over scales of order this. Yes. So the line of sight, any one line of sight is, right? But if we looked at different lines of sight and we find over which, we've got a bunch of lines of sight through here. And so the line of sight here and the line of sight here show completely different, then that gives us a feel for the scale. But we don't know exactly, because the Faraday rotation, as you say, is averaged along a line of sight. So it's coming through the whole great big three-dimensional ball of plasma here. Right? And that's one of the difficulties in interpreting what the magnetic field actually does. So these things are only rough guesses. In the inner region here, okay, so the importance from the mathematics point of view of this slide is set the scale of things. The important thing here is the size of the mean free path to the scale of what's going on. In these outer regions out here, the mean free path is something like 10 times bigger than the scale over which the magnetic field seems to change. So we imagine in this plasma, though we can't see it, that the field lines are all tangled up and chaotic inside this plasma, and the mean free path of an electron or an ion, they're about the same size, is about 10 times the distance for the field line to turn around. In the inner regions, the mean free path gets smaller than the size of the tangling, because the plasma in here is colder and denser. Coulomb collisions. Yeah, it's fully ionized at 1 to 10 kilovolts. Right? There isn't a neutral inside. So everything's Coulomb collisions. There is some radiative mean free path over which its synchrotron radiates, but that's a long distance.
Is the extension of the hot plasma compatible with gravitational?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so gravity, which I don't really want to go into too much, but gravity in this case is, there's a big collection of dark matter providing a big gravitational well here, right, which into which this plasma's fallen, and that's why it's so hot, right? It's come from the outside, and it rolls into this potential well, starts jiggling around, and it gets very hot. One more thing. The Lyman radius in this thing is negligibly small, 10 to the 9 centimeters, 10,000 kilometers, right? Really very, very small compared to anything else. So if you're imagining the motion of particles on these tangled field lines, it's very tiny little spirals of the particles around these tangled field lines. Now, I've been interested in this because as these galaxies go through this plasma, or bubbles of stuff bubble up through the plasma, it's going to stir it. And it stirs it, and since the plasma, the magnetic field in the MHD sense is almost exactly frozen into that plasma, right? The stirring will take field lines and move them around in the usual MHD sense and amplify the field due to a turbulent dynamo. And this could be the site at which we first see magnetic field in the universe, is in structures like this. And so I would like to simulate these plasmas rather carefully. As the galaxy goes through these plasmas, it's going through at about 1,000 kilometers a second, which is a little bit bigger than the sound speed, but not a lot. Right? So the galaxy is moving at about the speed of an ion as it moves along here, a proton, but 40 times slower or thereabouts than an electron moving along these field lines. Right? Now again, the Lyman radius is 10 to the 9 centimeters, and this is something like 10 to the 22 centimeters. So the Lyman radius is incredibly small here. It's very well magnetized plasma. And we really don't know how well it's stirred, because there are only 1,000 galaxies in there, and they're rather small, and they probably don't provide all the stirring. It's also true that we get convective stirring because the middle of the plasma gets hot, buoyant things that rise up through the plasma and stirs it around. Yes, Salim? So we don't. We tend to put in a random field at the beginning of any simulations of this kind of thing. So there are mechanisms for producing seed fields in here. Basically, the thermoelectric effect will do it. As the plasma falls into this thing, it starts to ionize. And in the ionization fronts, as it comes in, you get a kind of thermoelectric effect, which is called the Biermann battery, right? And that gives rise to magnetic field and seed magnetic fields. And then those magnetic fields, however small, get stretched and tangled by the turbulence, and they get to strong sizes. So simulations of these things, of course, simulating turbulence is always a little bit of a hard thing to do. And MHD turbulence is certainly harder than fluid turbulence. You've got more equations to solve. And actually, very little is known about MHD turbulence. I mean, there's been a lot of very clever work over many years, but it's even now, even the spectral exponents of MHD turbulence are in debate. We've done a lot of very large-scale, 256-cubed mostly, simulations of MHD turbulence, where you just take a periodic box with the MHD equations, and you simulate random stirring of this thing. And the random stirring is supposed to simulate things like galaxies going through the plasma, winding up the magnetic field. And what you tend to see is actually structures that look like this, and this is one of the things, this is another talk, but it's relevant to what we're talking about here, is that you tend to see the magnetic field lining up in folded structures. Here it's going one way, here it's going the other way, here it's going the other way. You see these large-scale folds of magnetic fields and reversals of the sign of the magnetic field across these large-scale folds. This is a fully saturated state of randomly stirred MHD turbulence in a box. Now, what's interesting about this plasma is the viscosity isn't small. The mean free path is long, right? So what you would naively say the viscosity was, if you took formula for scalar viscosity, would give you a Reynolds number that's really not very large. But the resistivity, right, what destroys the magnetic field, right, is incredibly tiny in these plasmas. So the magnetic field can be made into very small-scale objects, but the actual velocity is really quite a large-scale thing, right? Because the viscosity is so large, you won't get small-scale velocities. Or at least in a naive sense, you wouldn't. And so this is called large magnetic Prandtl number limit of MHD turbulence. And so the magnetic Prandtl number is the ratio of viscosity, which damps the velocity part of the turbulence, to resistivity, which damps the magnetic part of the turbulence. I'm going to show you some equations in a moment. But this is actually the spectrum of the simulation, or one of the ones on here, that you just saw. And what happens in those cases is, even though the velocity is on very large scales, and here is K, right, we're in a periodic box, and this here, dotted line, is the velocity spectrum, because we're at low Reynolds number, and so it cuts off at small K. But the magnetic spectrum goes right out to very small scales, very large K, right, because you take those field lines and you fold them over on themselves many, many times and tangle them up onto small scales. And in fact, the magnetic spectrum here is almost flat. And we believe, we now have a theory of it, that the spectral exponent here is about k to the 0.23. So if we had really, really small resistance, you would see this spectrum stretch out way over here and be almost flat all the way out and then cut off. What you see here is the effect of resistance cutting it off. So you have... Yes?
You have an estimate of the
spectrum. It's about one. Yes. This is an incompressible simulation. So we're assuming beta is very large for the simulation, but that's because mathematically the compressible simulations are much harder and much more expensive to do. Yes, sorry, Terry. Because it's large mean free path. The mean free path in here is almost the size of the structure that we see in the clusters of galaxies. It's a low density plasma. They go the other way around, right? The resistivity is proportional to the collisionality, so it's very small, but the viscosity is inversely proportional to the collisionality and increases with mean free path. And so when you have a very low-density plasma, the ratio of viscosity to resistivity is enormous. It's actually 10 to the 18 in this case. Obviously, it's not in the simulation. So what we've been doing is we've been simulating the usual MHD set of equations, and I have to assume that you've vaguely seen things like this in your life. density equation, pressure equation. Magnetic field equation, of course, here's where the resistivity comes in. I always use the terminology, eta for the resistivity. And those simulations were done with a momentum equation where the viscous term is given by the simple mu del squared V, normal Laplacian scalar viscosity, with a large coefficient mu, right? So that the Reynolds number of the flow was not a whole lot bigger than 1. And we've certainly played with the Reynolds number, but that's, again, another talk. What you find, because of the long mean free path here, is that really the conventional MHD, which ignores heat flow and just replaces viscosity with some scalar, is not going to be right here, and it's not the set of equations you should be solving, because the heat flow of the electrons is really quite substantial here. Remember, electrons carry heat much faster than ions because they're much lighter and they move much faster along the field lines. And so that's one thing that we're going to now look at. And the other thing is the viscosity in a magnetized plasma is not a scalar viscosity, because particles can't move across the field lines, right? They move a Lama radius across the field lines. They're going in these little helices along the field lines. But they can move vast distances along the field lines before they collide. So the viscosity that appears in here is a tensor viscosity related to the fact that the particles can only move along the field lines and not across the field lines. And so you can't mix momentum, viscosity I think of as mixing momentum, right? You can't mix momentum except along the field lines. So you really need to get some idea of how to treat the large heat flows and the large and the tensor viscosities. So this actually kind of says what I just said, which is that the motion of particles, especially the electrons, right, is incredibly fast along the field lines. Right? The electrons are moving 40 times faster along the field lines than the field lines are changing, because they're changing roughly at the speed that the ions are moving along the field lines. And the mean free path is not short. It's almost the size, or it can be even bigger than the structures we're interested in. Two effects change the transport along. So all transport effectively goes along field lines. Particles move across field lines so slowly that if you're talking about taking heat from this point to this point, it has to be done along whatever magnetic field line goes from those two points. And therefore, how heat flows from here to here depends critically on whether the particle has to go round in circles many times before it gets there, or whether it can go directly in a straight line between those two. And so the wandering of the field lines impedes the transport of heat and particles. And also, when you go along a field line, magnetized particles can be mirrored by strong regions of the field, and therefore that they don't move unimpeded along the field lines. They come to a point where the field is very strong, and they get reflected back from it, and that also impedes the transport along field lines. So I'm going to describe both those effects, and we're actually getting to some mathematics now. Well, my version of mathematics. So, again, the guiding center motion, if there were no collisions, right, the motion of the part, this is of course an exaggerated spiral because it's 10 to the 13 times smaller than the size of this object. Going around this field line, here's a particle spiraling around the field line. We're going to call this typical length over which the field reverses LB, the tangling length. And if you go along these field lines, you're preserving the energy of the particle because the magnetic field doesn't change the energy of the particle. And there's an adiabatic invariant. It's largely perpendicular to the field line, so the parallel electric field is negligible, right? Because you're almost MHD. There's another subject there that we could go into for hours. But the magnetic moment of the particle is also preserved, and this, of course, as is well known in guiding center theory, says that the parallel velocity, right, is related to these two constants, E and mu, and the strength of the field. So you get mirroring, the parallel velocity decreases in regions of strong magnetic field and increases in regions of weak magnetic field. So you, if the particle can move along the field line to a point, it reaches the region where the field is very strong, it'll get mirrored and it'll come back down the field line again. This subject, okay, so now I'm in, I guess I didn't really signal this in my thing, but now I'm into the issue of how do we calculate the flow of heat in a situation like this. This might be the hotter part of the plasma over here. This might be the colder part of the plasma over here. And hot particles moving along the field lines will move along the field lines maybe towards the cold part, transporting heat between the two. Right? We want to calculate that heat flow. But in detail, we don't want to have to worry about the structure of the field too much. We'd like some kind of average heat flow between this region over here and this region over here. Especially if the field is extraordinarily tangled, right? It's going to have to go very long distances along the field line to transport heat from here to here. Right? So we'd like some kind of averaged effect of what happens there. Now, as the particle goes along the field line, it collides. And so for the moment, let's just worry about how do we calculate heat flow along one of those field lines. Right? So as you go along the field line, you're making a random walk. You go a certain distance along the field line, you collide, and then you go back down the same field line. So when you're in a one, you're in one dimension, really, moving along the field line, and so the length along the field line goes the square root of the diffusion curve, the collisional diffusion coefficient times the time, right, as you go along the field line. This is a well-known argument, by the way. It's not mine. It's been around for 30 years. So as you move along the field line, right, the field line diffuses in space itself. And field lines, in a sort of scalar model, in situations like this, I'm going to assume that the field line makes a random walk of step length LB in space. So as you move along the field line, you're random walking through three-dimensional space because the field line is moving around. So there's a second random walk. Right? And that's the random walk of the field line in space. So here's the distance along the field line. Here's the random walk step length. And the distance you move in three-dimensional space is the square root of the geometric mean of those two objects. Right? So the distance you move in space only goes like the square root of the distance you've moved along the field line. So if you ask how far do you move in three-dimensional space in a time t, due to these double random walks, the random walk along the field line and the random walk of the field line in space, you get what we call double diffusion, right? The actual step that you've made, this of course is the mean, the RMS step length, is this goes like the quarter root of time, which is not diffusion, right? Diffusion would be going like the square root of time. So you're not actually going to diffuse if you stick to the same field line. So as you're wandering down this field line, you're going down the field line backwards and forwards, and you can come back to the same point, right, down the field line. The field line is wandering in space. And your actual motion through space, the distance you've traveled from the point you started, right, is only going to go like the quarter root of time. So this would not produce, over long times, would not produce diffusion. It's called double diffusion. To actually get diffusion, the particle will have to leave the field line. This argument is essentially watertight, though not the way I've presented it. So you'll have to leave that field line, but particles don't leave the field line rapidly at all, right? They can only make a jump across the field line in a collision of order the Lama radius, which is 10 to the 13 times smaller than the size of the object, right? So they get across the field lines very, very slowly. Rechester and Rosenbluth in, 1978, worried about this in fusion devices. And they pointed out that when you have a tangled field, small distances across the field lines can be amplified by just the divergence of field lines within a stochastic situation where the magnetic field lines are chaotic. So here, consider two field lines that are very, very close together at the beginning, right? They they're so close together at the beginning that the particle going around on its Lama radius could be really equally considered to be on both field lines, right? So they're very, very close together at the field line. Now you follow this, right? This is the wonders of doing PowerPoint. You can copy the picture and then just alter the end of it. So you follow these field lines around, right? You keep following them, and as you follow them, right, because you're in a, they're feeling just slightly different forces, they'll start to diverge from each other. And the further apart they get, the more rapidly they're going to diverge from each other. And you'll see, right, that if we go a certain distance along the field line, and we start in only a Lama radius apart, right, these two field lines will have separated by a distance of order the tangling length. So they're now completely decorrelated field lines. Now, your random walking particle, your electron going along here, is making a random walk along this field line. Right? And the problem in double diffusion is it could random walk its way all the way back to the beginning again. Right? And it is entirely reversible because you're always on the same one-dimensional line. But in this case, right, the particle is not quite stuck to the field line. And every time it collides, it makes a jump of order the Lama radius. And what happens is that, you know, the particle could have jumped right here onto the next field line. And by the time we've got to here, it's in an entirely decorrelated position. So we define, right, the three-dimensional step length that you... Okay, back up, sorry. We define the length you go along the field line for the two field lines that started a Lama radius apart to separate by the tangling length to be the Retchester-Rosenbluth length, and we call it LRR. That's the length along this tangled field line. Right? But if we've gone a distance LRR along the field line, we made a step in three-dimensional space due to the fact that the field line is diffusing through space of order delta RR, right? Which is the square root of LB LRR. Right? That's just the usual random walk argument in three-dimensional space. Right? And the time it takes us to go this distance, LRR, is called, well, it's in fact going to be the correlation time of another random walk, right? And because we're diffusing along the field line, that time is the Retchester-Rosenbluth length along the field line, LRR, which is the length along these tangled field lines to there, right, squared, divided by, this is the diffusion coefficient of particles along the field line. Now, if the particle got to this end point, oh, we're supposed to do that. Got to this endpoint, suffered a collision at this endpoint, and started going backwards. Right? It would never come back to the beginning again here, because by the time you've got there, it's on a slightly different field line if it suffered a collision at the end here and went backwards. It would go back, but it would lose correlation with the other field lines, and it would go over to here rather than to there. So if you make... If you get this far and you reverse back down the same field line, you're really not going back down the same field line. So this is going to be, if you went back down now, you'd make an uncorrelated step in space. So Retchester and Rosenbluth's argument was that in fact the random walk that you're going to make has this step length, right, and it takes this time to do it. Right? So we're going to make a random walk in space with this step length and this time to do it. And that will be random walks by going along the field line, diffusing along the field line, until the field line's uncorrelated with its neighbor, right? And then diffusing along another field line until it's uncorrelated with its neighbor, etc. So it's these step lengths and these correlation times. And so when you work that out, the three-dimensional diffusion, not the diffusion along the field lines, the diffusion in space now of the electrons, right, is the tangling length times the diffusion along the field line divided by this Retchester-Rosenbluth length. Now, everything then depends on the structure of the field and how it comes in this length. Remember how I defined that length. That's the length you have to go along the field line for two felines that started a Lama radius apart to have got apart by LB. Now that really depends on what the turbulence is like, how the felines have been stirred. Right? If you take two orbits in a typical dynamical system that start very, very close together, right, we know from several theorems that they'll have Lyapunov exponents. Those two orbits will, at least initially, start to diverge from each other. They start infinitesimally close, diverge from each other due to exponential instability of the orbit. Right? And so, in fact, what Register and Rosenbluth said, right, is that we can estimate this length by assuming that we have the typical exponential instability of orbits, those are the felines, right? And the exponentiating length is something like the tangling length, right? And therefore the two felines will exponentiate apart, and so this Register Rosenbluth length is the tangling length times the logarithm of the tangling length over rho e. So it's only really exponentially sensitive to the initial separation, logarithmically sensitive to the initial separation of the felines, which was the Lama radius, right? Now this is an enormous number, 10 to the 13, right? And so the log of it is not small, but it's not larger either, you know. Well, in base 10, it's 13. So the Register-Rosenbluth length then is moderately longer, so you would get a reduction in the transport due to the fact that the particles are moving along these tangled fields. They can't go directly from the hot spot to the cold spot, right? You get a reduction there of order, well, actually it turns out to be of order 30 because it's log base e. And it's more than 10 to the 13. But this is actually not quite true. This estimate assumes that in your dynamical system of tangled magnetic felines, that two orbits diverge from each other exponentially, not just for infinitesimal separation, but all the way until they're separated of order the tangling length. Now, in turbulence, that's not what happens. If you take two particles inside Kolmogorov turbulence, and you take two little particles close together, and you ask, how do they separate? It's called the Richardson law, after a British physicist. And they separate, right, like T to the 3/2, I think, Richardson law. Anyway, the felines separate if you had a Kolmogorov turbulence of the felines. In other words, the felines have a K to the minus 3/2 kind of 5/3 spectrum. Right? Then the felines, separation D, a distance L along the feline, just goes D goes like L to the 3/2. This separation is remarkable because basically you start from zero separation, and you separate finitely from zero. There's no exponential, right? Finitely from zero all the way up to LB in basically a few tangling lengths. We take two felines that are infinitesimally separated because right on that small scale there's supposed to be a small scale eddy that's interacting with it, which will separate the felines a little bit. Then you move along a bit more and there's another eddy, another eddy, another eddy, and the felines separate like this. If this is true, then there's very little reduction in the electron transport. At this point, I should say there's good observational evidence that in some clusters, the electron transport is reduced by a factor of 100 because we observe the temperature profile and we can estimate how quickly the temperature profile would relax if there was no suppression of the electron transport, and we need a factor of 100 to explain the observed electron temperature. Yeah?
In your formula, you mentioned the Kolmogorov spectrum.
This is where we don't know the answer, right? I put this up as illustrative. In what's called Alphane wave turbulence, you're supposed to get a Kolmogorov-type spectrum. But this is not Alphane wave turbulence because the felines are highly tangled. And so I don't know what the spectrum is, and I don't know how to generalize it, and I don't even know that this is correct for the Alphane wave turbulence. What we've done, and Ben Chandon's done a lot of this, and he should be credited for this, is actually take simulations of MHD turbulence, which remember aren't really solving the exactly right equations, and numerically plot the divergence of field lines versus distance along the field lines, and then doing an ensemble of that to find out what this registered Rosenbluth length is in a numerical realization of the turbulence. Right? So he's done that, and the answers, as typical with numerical work, are completely inconclusive. It's a very hard thing to do, and we don't have enough scale range to see the distance, but you know, we're very soon up to the energy containing range, and what we're really trying to do is something like 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 ranges of scale. Right? So we're getting no scaling out of that. Not only that is, if you look back at the, oh, I don't think I'm going to go back because we'll get too lost, but if you look back at my pictures, that visualization of a turbulent simulation where you saw the red field lines folded over on themselves, that structure, we don't know how to explain that spectrally. We don't have a good spectral representation of that. And what field lines are doing is they stay close to each other very, very much. And then when you get to the corners and there are bends, one field line will go off like that and one will go like that. And so when we plot the separation of field lines versus distance, we see them staying very close together, and then we see them jumping up, and then we see them jump up again. There seem to be critical points as you go along where the field lines separate from each other very rapidly, and then they'll stay close together for a long time, and they'll separate very rapidly. And we don't know how to describe that either. So we would like to understand, I mean, we don't know. At this point, we're trying numerical things to try and get a better scaling idea of it. His estimate was that the registered Rosenbluth length was something 10 times LB, but, you know, this is, there's no scaling in that. We don't know why. Right? This number 10, is it truly has no scaling in it, or it's just our numerics, right? And we really don't know from the folded field. What am I doing for time? Looks like I might miss out viscosity. Well, up to this point, I've assumed that when an electron goes along the field line, the only thing that stops it moving is a collision, right? So it's going along the field line, it collides with something and comes back at you. But these field lines, especially in this folded case, as you go along the field line, you see a very varying magnetic field strength. So if you took a tube of magnetic field like this, and you go along it, the tube's narrow, field gets stronger here, the tubes get wider apart, field gets weaker over here. And so if I plotted the strength of the magnetic field as a distance along the field line, this is supposed to correspond, you'd see the strength go up, there'd be a sort of barrier here and go down. Now, for a particle that has no collisions, what will happen is it comes in, and due to conservation of its adiabatic invariant, it will mirror at this point and come back out again. Right? And here, comes in, it'll mirror, and it'll go back out again. And this will provide a barrier to heat flow along the field lines. We analyzed this sort of extensively, and there are different ways to do this. You could look at a sort of randomly distributed field, magnetic field strength along a field line, which is one thing we did. But what we've noticed from the simulations is that these barriers seem to be very well localized along field lines. So what we tried to do to understand what effect this would have on transport is look at the dynamics of individual barriers and then take an ensemble of barriers of different heights along the field line and use that to model how heat flow down the field line. And we solved essentially the collisional equation. This is the Lorentz collision operator for the electrons, and when the electrons scatter on ions, they have this pitch angle scattering. They just conserve their energy and change their pitch angle, and that's the collisional, we call it the Lorentz operator. Somebody else was talking about Lorentz operator. This is the effect of the mirroring force on the field, on the particles, and this is the streaming, and C is just the parallel velocity divided by the total velocity. Yes. The barrier will be moving, but compared to an electron, it's moving slowly. And it's the electrons carrying all the heat, not the ions. Yeah, that's true. And barriers move, and they can Fermi accelerate ions, for instance. And you can get things bouncing between moving walls, like ping pong bats. So you can solve this problem if you assume various orderings here. And one of the ones that produced a nice result, we've got like four papers on this and different regimes and all kinds of stuff. But mathematically, one of the nice ones is we've got narrow, tall barriers here. You can solve this collisional equation using what I call beta-bota functions. Bota and Hans Bethe used these to model electrons going into early days of high-energy physics, going into metals and things like that and slowing down, and they're the eigenfunctions. It's the separable solution, ignoring this term, of that and that. So outside here, you can use beta-bota functions as an eigenfunction expansion of the distribution function of electrons, and inside here, the electrons are virtually collisionless as they cross, the few electrons cross the barrier, and you can match them here and find that what happens to the distribution function is it decreases here just due to collisional diffusion, right? And when you hit the barrier, there's a jump, and every barrier produces a jump in the distribution function, and therefore a jump in the temperature between there and there, right? And the jump in the distribution function is given in terms of the heat flux, basically along the field line. And so each barrier has a jump proportional to the ratio of the maximum field to the sort of average field out here. And so each barrier will take a chunk out of the temperature. And so you imagine going along field lines, each time you encounter a barrier, there's a temperature drop across each barrier, right? And then you can look at the average temperature drop along field lines as you go through this region. And that proves to be very interesting, of course, because it depends on the distribution of barriers. If you have a distribution, power law distribution of barriers, you can get non-diffusive behavior out of this, essentially Levy flights. The particles go enormous distance and then suddenly encounter a very enormous barrier. And that dominates that's what dominates the thermal insulation of this plasma. We just say one barrier. We don't know, I mean, the point should be made is we don't know enough about the structure of the field to apply these results very effectively, because we just don't know how the field strength varies along a typical field line, except from the rather crude simulations that we've done. A further problem is that the simulations we've done are using a scale of viscosity, right? And viscosity is important. This is not large Reynolds number flow, so we've got to really get the viscosity right. And the real viscosity we should be using, suppose the mean free path were short. Even if the mean free path were short, we should be using this very complicated version of the viscous tensor, right, due to Brzezinski in 1958, where this wee b, little b, lowercase b, wee b, is the unit vector along the field lines. In fact, due to the Frozenin law, this term, b dot grad v dot b, is the rate of change of the strength of the magnetic field in that form, right? So what this represents here is very interesting physics. If you take a plasma and you just collisionally amplified the field, if the field got stronger, then you conserve the adiabatic invariant of the particle. So V perp squared over B is a constant. But B just went up everywhere. So the particle energy, the particle perpendicular velocity goes up. Even though no collisions has happened, you've actually sort of heated the plasma. Right? And the perpendicular velocity goes up, magnetic field goes up. So in any of these motions where you tangle the field and make the field stronger, right, the particles get accelerated by this. It's just the same thing that gives you the betatron. And so you strengthen the magnetic field and you put energy into the particles. Then collisions scatter those particles that have been energized only in the perpendicular direction, and that gives rise to this viscosity. Right? So you get heating out of this when you energize the electrons by increasing B and then collisionally scatter them. Right? And this produces this viscosity. It's called magnetic pumping. Yes. It's the exact invariant of the particles from which the equations are derived. It's exact invariant, but not under collisions.
Yeah, but when we have,
it's not exact, it's adiabatic.
Right?
we derived the transport coefficient and the MHD equations from the Boltzmann equation. Right? And when we do that, the Boltzmann equation, the collisionless part conserves that. A debat, yes. Up to e to the minus 1 over epsilon, where epsilon is 10 to the, minus 18. So it's e to the 10 to the 18, which is, this adiabatic theory ought to work here extraordinarily well. Right? It's an adiabatic invariant up to corrections of order e to the minus 1 over epsilon. And epsilon's so tiny, it really ought to be almost exact. Yes. No, there's an adiabatic invariant to all orders. There is an asymptotic expansion for it. But even in the asymptotic theory, to all orders, right, you've still got these corrections, which are e to the minus 1 over epsilon. I mean, this takes us way away from my subject, but it's... So the point is that this comes in the... Yeah, I've got 3 minutes. I'm there. So the point is, whenever you have a plasma that's stirred and it's fully ionized, you don't have viscosity in the classic sense. You have this kind of viscosity that comes from changing the magnetic field and then maybe changing it back again. Changing the magnetic field and changing it back again. In fact, if you look at the entropy production, sort of please you, Dave, the heating due to this term, it's proportional to the square of this, which is the rate of change of the magnetic field strength. And of course, it's got collisions in there because its entropy production must be due to collisions, right? And this is the collisionality, and this is obviously N and T, right? But the heating that you give is proportional to how much you're changing the magnetic field inside there. Now, nobody's used this viscosity. It's very hard to use in any code because it's highly anisotropic. It requires, if you go back and you just look at that expression here, to implement it in any code, you have this in terms of, say, in a spectral code, you have this in terms of some Fourier series, you have this in terms of some Fourier series, this in terms of some Fourier series, this in terms of some Fourier series, this in terms of, it's a mess. It's a hugely nonlinear object, right? And we tried to do it. The problem was, the answers came out just like scalar viscosity. And that could be for two reasons. The answers are just like scalar viscosity, or our resolution is very, very poor, and particularly the directions of the local directions of the magnetic field is very poor. And if you average over directions here, you end up with scalar viscosity. So it's probable, right, that we're getting the scalar viscosity answer because we simply haven't got enough resolution in our simulations, and we're just averaging over direction. I think I can ignore that. But even this is not right, because in fact, in these plasmas, we really should be dealing with long mean-free paths, and that viscosity is the Chapman-Enskog-derived magnetized viscosity. And the long mean-free path, right, is going to be trouble. Not only that, is viscosity due to ions. And ions in these plasmas are moving about the same speed at which you're stirring it. It's supersonic. The electrons are moving much faster. So for the electron problem, I just treated the field as frozen in time, followed the electrons in this frozen in time field. You can't do that for the ions because the field and the plasma is moving at about the same speed as the ions. So it becomes a horrendous problem. It's still conserving the mu, and it's probable that the way to attack this, and Greg Hammett has done some of this, is sort of with these closure equations. It would be out of the question to tackle it by solving the Boltzmann equation, just too hard, we wouldn't get enough resolution in the computer. But with closure equations, we might have a chance of going at this and getting the kinetic effects out of some closure-type relationship that Greg talked about the other day, where you include long mean-free path physics in a fluid description. But it needs work, and I'm not sure that that's really the way to do it. It wouldn't be worth doing this if it wasn't that this was the cradle of creation of magnetic field in the universe. Right? This is where it all starts, where we all get the magnetic fields that get frozen into galaxies and then eventually go into stars, eventually go into the sun and become part of the solar wind. It wouldn't be worth doing it if it wasn't sort of a critical problem in astrophysics, and that these effects are actually order one effects. If it were just a small correction, right, I wouldn't bother, right, because astrophysics doesn't need that kind of precision. But it's really an order one effect. These plasmas transport is as important as flow. And if we got some good transport coefficients, maybe we could doctor up our simulations. Although, as I said, we've already tried with viscosity and found it very difficult to get the kind of accuracy we needed to get good simulations out of it. Thank you very much.